But as I was putting the message online last night, I was kind of reviewing some stuff. And this has all the components that I like to put into a message, okay? And you probably don't even care, but I care, okay? So one, we're in the book of James, but there's a lot of controversy about the book of James. I don't know if you know this or not, but there's a lot of controversy. Should it be in the canon? And, you know, James sounds like he's not like with Paul. And so each week, I've matched up James with something Jesus said in Matthew. Did you guys catch that so far? Probably not, but I did, okay? And so, because I want you to, what James' teaching matches up with what Jesus taught. And then for like a bonus round, I've been able to incorporate something from the first five books of the Old Testament, which is kind of like the foundation of understanding God. And so I got James, and I have Matthew, and I have two things from the first five books, and they're not even like forced. They all fit naturally. And as I sat down, like, oh, this is good stuff. And so that's just how my mind works. And you're like, you probably don't even care, but there you go. That's how your pastor thinks. Okay, so here we go. Today we're going to look at a passage that addresses a complaint, a question, and a controversy, okay? And so three C sounds, but one's actually spelled with a Q. But so what's the complaint? People inside and outside the church often complain that Christians aren't any different than those that are not Christians. You've heard that complaint before? They're like, they complain about us because we're not any different than them, and we, you know, they think they're better than us, but they're not. And so that's the complaint that people have about people in the church, is that they're not any different, okay? And you might hear somebody say, well, why should I go to church? Because I'm just as good as that person, or I'm better. And or you have a person who was a Christian, and they get hurt by somebody in the church, and they complain, and they leave, and they go, look, I don't need church anymore because they're not any different. That's a common complaint about us. We kind of have to own it, okay? As people look at us and go, they're not any different. And then there's people, while the people on the outside question our behavior that doesn't match our talk, many people on the inside ask a different question, okay? They ask a different question from a completely different perspective. And they ask this. Now, they ask this. What is the least I have to do to be safe with God? Now, they would never say it in those terms because that sounds so ungrateful, right? And it sounds so not Christian. But it kind of sounds like this. If I am saved by grace, why do I have to do X, Y, Z, right? If I'm saved by grace, why do I have to do something? Or sometimes what happens is like if a person who, maybe they came to Christ at like 18 and now they're 35 and they're not living for God now. And at one time they asked Christ to forgive them and they said, I'm going to follow you. And then people ask the question, are they still okay with God? Are they still going to spend eternity with God, right? So on the outside, you have people who complain about Christian behavior. And on the inside, we have people who are thinking, what's the least we can do to be okay with God? Which, by the way, would probably cause the complaint from the outside, correct? You know, everybody's like, how come they're no different? And we're like, what's the least I can do? God will still like me, right? That kind of feeds the problem. And then the controversy is this. Are we saved by grace or by works? And if by grace, then the works that I do they matter? Okay, so for those of you that are like long-term Baptists, do not freak out, okay? We're saved by grace. Okay, so don't worry. I haven't like, you know, gone off the rails here. But this is a controversy, and this subject is why people aren't sure that James should be in the rest of the 26 books in the New Testament, okay? And so this kind of like start off here with Ephesians 2. This is the Apostle Paul writing Ephesians 2. For by grace you have been saved through faith, and this is not your own doing. It is a gift of God, not the result of works, so that no one may boast. So here's the thing. God gives grace, and we respond in faith. Okay, that's what Paul is talking about here. Is God shows grace to us. His son dies on the cross for us. He pays the penalty for our sins, and we respond in faith. If you happen to be a little bit more Reformed tradition, you would say that God even gives you the ability to have faith, okay? So you have God gives us grace, we respond in faith. And Paul, to make sure it's clear, says this, it is the gift of God, not a result of works, so that you can't boast. None of us can go, hey, I earned my way in. Nobody can do that, right? But James writes something that sounds like he disagrees with Paul. He's like, what is the deal here? Like, what are we going to do with that? So here we go. Let's dive in. So what James has to say, though, will apply to that people's complaint and our question and this controversy. So James chapter 2 says this. What good is it, my brothers, if someone says he has faith but does not have works? Can that faith save him? You imagine all Paul's friends are like, whoa. Ephesians 2, 8, 9 says this, right? So what good is it, my brothers, if someone says he has faith but does not have works? Question. Next question. Can that faith save him? And so then he goes on and gives an example. If a brother or sister is poorly clothed and lacking in daily food, and one of you says to them, go in peace, be warmed and filled, without giving them the things needed for the body, what good is that? That's a good question, right? So somebody, your neighbor, or somebody, they say your neighbor needs something, or somebody comes in our church, we run across somebody who has a need. And basically this go in peace, it was kind of like, have a nice day. You know, it was pleasant, but not like engaging. And then be warm and filled. So the guy is lacking clothes, he's hungry, and it's just simple words, be warm and filled. And I mean, think about this like, in today's terms. You see a homeless person on the road, and he's looking for food, he needs clothes, and you go, hey, I hope you get some food and clothes, and you drive on by. This is kind of the context, right? So what good is that? The answer is obvious. It's no good, right? And so that is James's, he's using that example when it comes to our faith. It's like if we say we have faith, but we don't have works, you know, is that helpful? And then in verse 17, he says this, and this is what got people all riled up. So also faith by itself, if it does not have works, is dead. Now James, once again, he doesn't sugarcoat it. Okay, he is not PC in the theological world. Okay, he's like direct. Okay, he's like, if you think you have faith and you have no works, your faith is dead. Okay, so what is James trying to tell the original reader and us now? Okay, so he uses this illustration of faith to address a personal theoretical question. To address a personal theoretical question, like, are we saved? He uses like a practical public example, right? And so he used an example of that person who just kind of blessed and verbally said, hey, I hope you have food. I hope you have clothes. And he just moves on. And so he's showing that doesn't work. Your well wishes and your politeness aren't going to help this person. And James says it's the same thing when it comes to your faith. That it's more than just intellectual consent. He says that type of faith is not helpful. So James anticipates some pushback. Okay, some resistance. Have you ever made a statement like at work, like at a board meeting or an employee meeting, and you know as soon as you make the statement, they're going to get riled up? That's what James knows where he's going, right? And so he says, he's prepared, so he writes this, but someone will say, you have faith and I have works. Show me your faith apart from your works, and I will show you my faith by my works. Okay, so picture, one guy's like, I've got faith. The guy's like, well, I've got works. Well, and the guy's like, prove your faith. I believe. You know what I mean? And so he's like, your works kind of show it. They demonstrate it. So our works and actions demonstrate the existence of one's faith. He's like, your works and actions demonstrate the existence of one's faith. So without works, how can you prove you really have faith? So when I was... Xander's sick. Okay. When I was about Xander's age, maybe a year older than Xander, I went to this camp down in Southern California, and we had this rock climbing track that I went on, okay? And I like half of rock climbing, okay? I love going up. It's exciting. You know, you get your finger holes. You shove your hand in there, and you twist your hand. It's kind of hard on the skin, but you twist your hand, and you get locked in there, right? And you twist your foot, you lock in. There's like a little... pinky holds and all kinds of cool stuff, right? And I'm climbing to the top, and they get to the top, and I'm like, yes, I am the man. I climbed the rock. And then they go, okay, you're going to rappel down now. I'm going to what? We're not going to just walk off the back down the path? No, we're going to rappel down. And I don't like that part of rock climbing, okay? And like, this rope can hold you. Now, the rope is about the size of your pinky. Take a look at your pinky, okay? Your life is held in this small, right? And they're like, you know, you're pulling it. It looks pretty solid. And they're like, and so literally I'm on the edge, okay? And I'm, and you just kind of have to like, let me back up. I almost fell in the baptistry last week, by the way. So you're going to have to, you lean back. I can't without falling, okay? But at some point in time, you're leaning back. You just kind of have to trust, right? And you hop off, right? And so I'm sitting there, and I'm like, and the guy's like, hop. And I'm like, I will. Hop. I'm going to. And he's like, you believe the rope? I'm like, yeah, then hop. And here's the thing. Theoretical consent, like I understand a rope can hold me, is different than biblical faith of let it hold me. There's a difference there, okay? And so that's kind of what, mentally, I could understand that this rope can hold my massive, like, 110-pound frame back then, okay? So it probably could have held, like, 10 of me, right? But the issue was me willing to trust my life on that cliff with that rock. And so belief and faith are linked with trust in the Bible, okay? So not every word that's translated trust comes from the same word that's translated faith, but a lot of them are, okay? So sometimes we look at our Bible, and in the English, we kind of miss some of this, okay? But it's not just a mentally I agree with something, okay? There's a trust factor. There's like a reliance there, okay? And so the word faith actually comes from a root word of trust. So John 3:16, for all, you know, for God's love the world, who believes, that believes could be trust, could be faith. It's not just like, I understand that Jesus is God. No, there's a trust and a faith in that, okay? So some of you might be thinking, well, I believe in God, and I believe that Jesus is God's son, but I want you to check out how James responds to that argument, okay? But before we go there, I need to understand something. In Deuteronomy 6, this is like my Old Testament thing here, Deuteronomy 6, verse 4, it says this, and this is like one of the key passages for the Jewish faith. Okay, this is like our Great Commission type verse. Okay, it says this: Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your might. And these words that I command you today shall be on your heart. So there's two key things here. One, you believe the Lord your God is one. At the time when this is written, Jewish monotheism was way different than all the other polytheisms of the time. Okay, this was a major statement of faith for the Jewish people, is our God is one, and therefore we will love him with all of our heart, soul, mind, and strength. Okay, this is a key thing here. Okay, yes, Deuteronomy 6. James is writing to these Jewish Christians who are scattered abroad, remember week one, and so he says this in verse 19, you believe that God is one. So he's going back to something that's going to trigger. They know what he's referencing. You believe this key theological truth, okay? He's like, and that would be like, that's what makes me Jewish. I believe that God is one. It's a big deal, right? And James goes, you believe that God is one, even the demons believe and shudder. I think that's true, okay? So like, well, I believe that God is just. The demons believe, the demons know God is just. I believe that God loves me. The demons know that. So have you ever noticed in the New Testament when you're reading through and Jesus does something and a demon shows up, they know who Jesus is? To me, that should be like proof number one that Jesus is who he is, right? The demons go, they know who he is. They don't doubt who he is. They don't go, well, you're not really the Son of God. They know. And James is like, oh, you think you're so big because you know that God is one? The demons do. The demons knew. They didn't doubt who Jesus was. They just weren't trusting Jesus. They had said, I know who you are, and I don't want that. They knew. So now James is going to demonstrate this point with the father of faith, Abraham. Okay, so Abraham is huge. You know, he's like the person in the Old Testament, him and Moses. And so I need to kind of review Abraham's life so you understand this argument he's going to make. Genesis 12 says this, Now the Lord said to Abram, Go from your country and your kindred and your father's house to the land that I will show you, and I will make you a great nation. I will bless you and make your name great so that you will be a blessing. I will bless those who bless you, and on him who and him who dishonors you, I will curse. And in you, all the families of the earth shall be blessed. Verse 4, so Abram went, as the Lord had told him, and Lot went with him. There's a ton packed in this verse, okay? A ton. But for today's message, God made a promise to Abraham and says, I need you to go somewhere, and I'm going to make you into a great nation. And he went. He distrusted what God said. There's a man, Abram's married, he's got no kids, he's got a lot of wealth, he's got no kids, and God says, I just need you to move. You're going from one town to like a whole different part of the world here, and I want you to, and I'm going to make you into a great nation. And Abraham just said, okay. Think how rarely we just go, okay. Right? But Abraham's like, he just goes. That's verse, chapter 12, verse 1, first couple of verses. Then in 15, we get to like the bigger issue. He can't be a great nation if he doesn't have kids. That's a huge problem, okay? You know, and so he needs to have kids. And verse 4 says this, and behold, the word of the Lord came to him. The man, let me back up. Abram tried to make a shortcut, had a boy with another lady and got complicated. And so, and God says, I want you, you're going to have another kid. And Abraham's like, I'm too old. Just let the other guy work. And God says, no. Verse 4, and behold, the word of the Lord came to him. This man, the other son, shall not be your heir. Your very own son shall be your heir. And he brought him outside and said, look toward heaven and the number of the stars, if you're able to number them. Then he said to them, so shall your offspring be. And he believed the Lord, and he counted it to him as righteousness. So God says, look at the stars, Abraham. You're going to have that many heirs someday. And this is, God is saying this to a guy who is really old. You know, and he's like, you're going to have a child someday. And verse 6 says, and he believed the Lord. And he counted it to him as righteousness. God's like, I'm going to do the impossible in your life, Abraham. And Abraham says, I believe you. And God says, you're righteous. Paul loves this verse because it's righteousness based upon faith, right? This is Paul's bread and butter, right? And then chapter 22, to tell the story, God tells Abraham, okay, now Abraham, that heir I promised you, I've given him to you, I want you to go sacrifice him. Imagine Abraham's like, okay, God, you promised that Isaac would be the heir, and now you want me to kill Isaac? That seems like it's going to complicate the plan. But Abraham says, okay, and he goes to sacrifice Isaac. And the last second, God says, don't do that, you know, and he rescues him. So that's this very brief story of Abraham. And now here's what James says. Do you want to be shown, you foolish person, once again, very polite, that faith apart from works is useless? Was not Abraham, this is their father of faith, our father justified by works when he offered up his son Isaac on the altar? You see that faith was active along with his works, and faith was completed by his works. As the scripture was fulfilled that says, Abraham believed God, and it was counted to him as righteousness, and he was called a friend of God. You see that a person is justified by works and not by faith alone. So James is not arguing that faith doesn't lead to justification and doesn't lead to forgiveness, okay? What he's arguing is this, that if your faith doesn't produce some action or some evidence, it's not saving faith. So he's like, he's looking at Abraham's life. He's like, look, Abraham believed in chapter 12. And Abraham believed in chapter 15. And then when the issue, when circumstances happened, chapter 22, that faith from 12 and 15 produced works. Do you see that? He's like, that faith had evidence. That faith led to something. It wasn't just a mental agreement to something, but it led to some action. He put it on the line. He literally put his son on the altar because of what he believed in chapter 12 and chapter 15. Okay? So saving faith is living faith. Okay? Saving faith is living faith. That means if you say you believe something, that you trust something, that you have faith in something, it should affect the way you live. James goes, believing something's true, like the demons do, is not enough. It involves more than your brain. It involves your will. Saving faith is living faith. Then he gives another example in chapter verse 25. And in the same way was not also Rahab, the prostitute, justified by works when she received the messengers and sent them out by another way. For as the body apart from the spirit is dead, so also faith from apart from works is dead. And really quickly, this lady was in Jericho. Israel's going to come through and wipe out Jericho. And she believed the God of the Israelites. And she made a choice. I want to be on your side. I will help in this plan. Okay? And her belief in their God led to actions. She made a decision to not side with the Jericho people and to side with these people. And she actually ends up being in the genealogy of Jesus Christ. So her faith led to some action. So why do James and Paul sound like they disagree? Why do they sound like they disagree? Paul is focused on faith and trust in Christ alone for salvation. That's Paul's big thing, is faith for salvation. And so he's often writing to a bunch of Jewish people who wanted to impose the law. Okay, so let's pretend Jewish, Gentile, okay? And Dustin, Gentile, and Dustin wants to come to Christ. And the Jewish people go, you need to obey the Ten Commandments. And Dustin's like, what are the Ten Commandments? I'm like, oh, it's the Jewish faith, right? And then they want to impose this law that they're used to on this. And frequently, and I'm like, almost, the majority of Paul's letters, he has to fight this issue with people. It's like, and so he's like, no, you don't have to follow those laws to become justified. So that's Paul's focus there. Paul teaches that we're not good enough to earn salvation, okay? Paul is leading people to trust in what Christ did on the cross, okay, as opposed to following this Old Testament law. So that's Paul's stuff there. Dude, I'm going to skip the next slide, okay? So Paul is focused on the means to salvation. He's focused on the means of salvation in Christ, which is our faith. Faith is the means, and then God's grace, okay? So he's focused on that, but James is focused on the result of that faith. They're looking at it from two different perspectives, okay? James is saying, if you have faith that's led to salvation, it's going to do something in your life. Even Paul says, in one of his arguments, that we don't overthrow and get rid of the law, that we uphold it, we value it, okay? So, let me say this. We don't do what's right. We don't live for God. We don't obey God, his word, so that God will love us. We don't do this so he'll forgive us and save us. Everybody who gets baptized, I tell them this, that getting baptized is not going to make God love you more. It's not going to make you more holy. It just tells people what's already happened, okay? So your obedience, you don't obey so God's going to like you more. What happens is this, is you do what's right, you live for God, and you obey because he loves us. Not so he'll love us. We obey because he loves us. We want to. Because he loves us. It's kind of like when you love somebody, you do things for them. Not so that they'll love you more, but just because they already do. So we kind of looked at Paul's stuff. We looked at James's stuff. Let's look at Matthew 7. This is Jesus, okay? Matthew 7 says this. Beware of false prophets who come to you in sheep's clothing, but inwardly are ravenous wolves. I always love these Jesus passages that do not fit what people always think about Jesus, right? But he's like, beware of false prophets who come to you in sheep's clothing, but inwardly are ravenous wolves. There's people in the midst of Christians that look like sheep, but they're wolves. They're going to look one way, but in reality, they're completely different. Verse 16 says this, you will recognize them by their fruits. James uses the word works. Okay, this is results. You'll recognize them by their fruits. Are grapes gathered from thorn bushes or figs from thistles? I'm not a huge gardener, but I know that's not true, right? So every healthy tree bears good fruit, but the diseased tree bears bad fruit. A healthy tree cannot bear bad fruit, nor can a diseased tree bear good fruit. Every tree that does not bear good fruit is cut down and thrown into the fire. Thus you'll recognize them by their fruits. Jesus is here saying this, give it some time and their true nature will reveal itself. Okay? If they have faith, it's going to result in some fruit. Or in James's words, it's going to result in some works. And if they don't really have faith, it's going to come out also, that they're going to have other displays. And then verse 21 says this, not everyone who says to me, Lord, Lord, will enter the kingdom of heaven. but the one who does the will of my Father who is in heaven. On that day, many will say to me, Lord, Lord, did we not prophesy in your name, and cast out demons in your name, and do mighty works in your name? And then I will declare to them, I never knew you. Depart from me, you workers of lawlessness. So, think about that. There's somebody who's going to cast a demon out in Jesus' name, or they're going to perform some miracle, and Jesus is going to say, I don't even know you. Okay? So Jesus makes a distinction between a person who does religious actions that other people would go, ooh, that's religious, and is from doing the will of the Father. He makes that distinction there, okay? So what should we do with this letter that James writes to us? How do we apply this to our life? And how does this change us? First off here, when you are wondering what is the minimum required evidence of your faith, you have the wrong focus. Can we just say that? If your question is, what's the minimum I can do that's evidence of my faith, you have the wrong focus. You're like, oh, I would never do that. I hope not. But I have known people who are like, well, I used to do this, so I'm sure I'm okay. But we have the wrong idea here. And in fact, this type of thinking would never show up in James' letter or Paul's, either one. None of them would ever go, hey guys, here's the absolute nitty-gritty, bottom of the line, essential one thing you have to do, and God's okay. That's never the idea. Paul is like, God's done everything for you, give your life to him. James is like, God's done everything for you, do something for him. It's always like a motive to want to do something, right? And so when you're thinking, what's the least, you're in the wrong, you're not even thinking biblically. You're missing the whole point. And this is probably the reason why people outside the church look at people inside the church and go, they're no different, because truthfully, they're not. And James would say, they probably don't have saving faith, because it hasn't grabbed them, it hasn't gripped their life and made them to live differently. Second thing, I want you to ask yourself, what do my actions declare about my belief in God? What do my actions declare about my belief in God? I was recently reading a book, and one of you guys, my friends, Gabe, told me to read this book. And it talks about the fact that everything we believe about God leads to an action, which is exactly what James is telling us, right? And so look at your actions, and what do they declare about your belief in God? So, question. Do you take God with you to school or work? You're like, he's omnipresent. I know he's everywhere. But when you go to work, do you consciously realize God is with me? If the answer is no, then what does that say what you believe about God? I'm hypothetical. Okay, I don't know your life. But it's possible you don't take God to work with you because you don't believe that God has a plan for what you're doing there. Right? Or you don't take God to work with you because you don't believe that God's redeemed that for his kingdom also. See, we get sometimes it's easier for us to just keep God at church, right? But when he wants to get involved on Monday through Saturday, it just gets so complicated and messy. We got to think about it. We got to pray to him, and we got to talk to him, and we have to ask his advice. And if it's just Sunday morning from 10 to 11, it's so easy, right? But if we don't take God to work with us, we don't think about it, there's a belief behind that, that what you do there doesn't matter, or that God doesn't care what's going on there, or that God can't work there. Like, well, I work at the state, and, you know, God can't work at the state. That's not really true, okay? So we have, like, you understand, our actions follow a belief. Same thing about like marriages and relationships. If we don't include God in them, what does that say? That God can't work in that situation? Or that God doesn't care? There are some times where I find myself struggling with something, and I'm like, why don't I just trust God with this? And I find myself kind of like, do you debate with yourself? Okay, good. So I'm not alone. So I argue with myself like a lawyer. Like I know, Kyle, I should have been a lawyer. So I'm arguing with myself about why I'm doing something, and I find myself going, God, I'm really sorry, because I think I believe you don't care. And that's why I'm doing what I'm doing. Now, hopefully you guys are better than I am, but sometimes as I kind of whittle it down to what the real situation is because it's a belief about God that affects my behavior. Like, I don't think he cares about this part of my life. Or I don't think he loves me enough. Like, it sounds weird, but I know God loves you, but sometimes I doubt he loves me. And so it's a belief about God that shapes behavior. Just like James says, our faith determines our works, right? Maybe you don't pray and you don't talk to God about your finances. Why? Because you don't believe God's plan works for finances. You know, I believe in the God of Visa and not the God of the Bible, right? And we don't trust with something there. All of our actions follow a belief about God, whether it's a correct belief or a wrong belief. 3. I think James would argue that we need to pursue a life with Jesus instead of settling for information about Jesus. Pursue a life with Jesus instead of settling for information about Jesus. That passage about the demons believe in shudder. The demons had the information. They knew who Jesus was. They knew who God was. When Satan is going attacking Jesus, Satan knows the Bible. I mean, Satan quotes the Bible, okay? And so they had the information. So James and Paul and Jesus, they're all challenging us to pursue a life with Jesus instead of settling for information about Jesus. So what does this mean to pursue a life with Jesus? Expect him to do something in your life. It's a way of looking at stuff. Do you just think you're going to show up at church on Sunday and then Monday through Saturday is yours and God doesn't care about that? No. If you want to pursue a life with him, you're expecting him to show up. You're expecting him to talk to you about what you're doing. Expect him to put you to work in his plan. Now, honestly, I look at the world and sometimes I wonder what God's doing, okay? But I trust he has a plan. I have faith, I believe those statements, right? And so therefore, I am looking for how he wants to use me. Even though I look at the world and I'm like, my gosh, it's a mess sometimes, but I have faith that God has a plan, and I have faith that he includes me in that plan, so therefore, I'm looking for directions. I wake up in the morning, I'm like, God, what do you want me to do today? And suddenly somebody will call me up and I'm like, really, God, you want me to talk to that person today? Okay. But so the idea here is if you're pursuing a life with Jesus, you're expecting him to do something. You're expecting to put you to work in his plan. And honestly, ready for this? Expect your life to change. You're not a finished product yet. God's still doing stuff. And so if you're pursuing a life with him, your life is going to change. It's going to get complicated. He's going to ask you to take steps of faith, and you're going to have to believe all over again. He's going to ask you to do things that you were not prepared to do, and he's going to stretch you. If something is in your life, Jesus will affect it. If you're pursuing a life with Jesus, if there's something in your life, you name it, kids, marriage, finances, hobbies, free time, TV, internet, eating, sleeping. If it's in your life, Jesus is going to affect it. You see, because you're pursuing a life with him, and he cares about all that. He's redeemed all that. He has a purpose for all of that to help you have a better life with him. Now, here's what I've noticed in my life, and I don't think I'm alone. When you stop letting Jesus affect some area in your life, then you believe you know better. Right? You know, like, so when you stop, and sometimes it happens subtly, and sometimes it's just like black and white, you just know it. Like, I have just said, no, God, I'm doing it my way. I know better on this. But so when we say, God, this area is not for you, then what we're saying is that we believe that we know better. Okay, so God says, you know, don't spend money on that. And the God's and I say, no, God, you don't understand the value of a 70-inch TV, right? That's my big covet thing, right? Okay, and or God says, I don't want you to talk like that at school. And you're like, God, you understand. This is how you make friends. I believe I know better about making friends than you do, right? Or it could be a spouse situation or a career situation. But when we say God, no, we're basically saying we believe, no, we know better. And so this belief and action goes both ways. We can look at our actions and we can determine what we believe, right? And James would say, if you believe, it will lead to actions. Many of us started on our journey of faith, and we started pursuing a life with Jesus. I think most of us, when we stepped into this, we wanted a life with Jesus more than just some information. We were, you know, we gave our lives to Christ, and then somewhere along the way, we started to settle for just knowledge. You probably have known some Christians like this, but I've known people like they've been a Christian for 50 years, and they're mean. I'm not going to name any of you guys, okay? I'm joking, not you. But have you ever known some older Christians that have been Christian for 50 years and you're like, they're mean? Or they're not forgiving? Or they're not gracious? And you're like, spending time with Jesus should have changed you. And what happens, somewhere along the line, they settled for knowledge about God and not a life with him, right? And so sometimes I think we do that too, right? We're pursuing a life with him, and then we get busy with other stuff. And so it's so easy to settle for just knowledge. And so my challenge for you guys today is this: as we close this, I want you to think about, am I pursuing a life with Jesus? In the book of Revelation, there's this letter that's going to these different churches, and it says this in Revelation 3, we're going to close. To the angel of the church in Sardis, right? So he's talking to this church in Sardis. The words of him who has the seven spirits of God and the seven stars. I know your works. You have the reputation of being alive, but you're dead. It's like, I know what you've been doing. You have a reputation. You used to be alive, but you're dead. Wake up and strengthen what remains and is about to die, for I have not found your works complete in the sight of my God. We're not done. Let God continue to work in us. God's not finished with you. He's not finished with me. He's not finished with one life. So let's pursue a life with Jesus that reflects our belief that Jesus is the victorious Son of God, that Jesus has a purpose for our lives.